Welcome to a Bow Valley Christian Church podcast. We're about helping people find and follow Jesus. In this episode, you are listening to Gary Lapine share his message titled, So What Do You Want to Do With That? From the series titled, These Three Remain. This message was broadcast live August 20th, 2023.
Morning, church. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Gary Lapine. I am a member here, and I have the honor to share with you this morning's message. A lifetime ago, when I was a wee lad of 17, I moved from Edmonton to Calgary to come to school. And if that wasn't traumatic enough, 4 years later, I moved to Illinois in the Midwestern states to attend grad school, which was truly a cross-cultural experience for me. I met lots of interesting people there, Dave from Indiana, Bob from California, Kim from Korea, Felix from India. Felix was an interesting guy. He actually saved me because the airline lost my luggage going down, and so Felix came to my rescue to welcome me to this new place. What was also interesting with Felix was there's an ongoing conversation between him and his parents throughout the year because in Indian tradition, his parents had found a lovely young woman for him to marry, but Felix had decided that he preferred the American approach better, and so there was this struggle about how he would find a life partner. It really got interesting when his sister got into the conversation, because for reasons I didn't understand, that since she was younger than he was, she wasn't allowed to marry till he did, and so she was on his case as well. So we had lots of good conversations about what all that meant. Another student was there. It was Cornelius, or we called him Corky. I have no idea why, but we called him Corky. Corky was an African-American who grew up on the streets of Detroit. And before he became a follower of Jesus, his life was filled with interesting stories of shoeboxes full of $100 bills and other paraphernalia. So Corky attended, his First Baptist Church in the Illinois area, and he was presenting his first message to the congregation. And so Dave from Indiana and Bob from California and I thought we would go and support our fellow student in this endeavor. Now, this truly was a cross-cultural experience like I had never experienced before. It was something. The enthusiasm, the energy, the active engagement, the enthusiasm was just, I don't know how to describe it to you other than it was like an entire auditorium full of G-Days when he's up here praying and gets excited. I mean, just that's what we're dealing with here. Like it was unreal. And then all kinds of things that I noticed. So for instance, the visitor greeting part of it. So Cal does this, we do this at Bow Valley, right? Partway through our service, we ask, would you stand and shake the hands of people around you? And for those introverts in our audience today, my apologies, I understand, I share your pain. Hopefully we didn't traumatize you too badly with doing that. It's just, we have to appease the extroverts a little bit. So that's what we do. But in this congregation, they ask you to not only just stand, but to introduce yourself to the entire congregation, and which you do. And then when you're done, the preacher looked at us and said, would you like to come up front and share a word? And I was like, dude, share a word. I'm trying to inconspicuously hide in the back row. You're not helping. Hey, it's just like, I don't know what to do with all of this. And then the offering time came. Now, this was a production. Now, I know things have changed since COVID. Like, we don't even do the passing down the trays anymore. But not only did they pass on the trays, but it was full-on singing and dancing. And the whole, it was unbelievable. I was just, this is amazing. And it didn't happen while we were there, but rumor had it that if, when the plates were gathered and brought back up to front, if the preacher looked and didn't feel like that there was enough given, he'd send it around for another pass. Yeah, let's give that a shot. That would be something. I think we'd have a revolt. The other thing that I noticed was that Dave from Indiana, Bob from California, and Gary from Alberta were the only white people in the building that day. And let me be very clear, we felt completely welcome. There was no issues, no concerns. But for me, it highlighted something that I discovered or felt in my year in the Midwest, that there was this underlying tension this racial tension that has existed in the U.S. for a long time. And the churches were struggling with it, and it persists even today. Some of you are aware that I work for Alberta Health Services as a clinical ethicist. And as part of my role, I support the Northwest Territories. And as Mike mentioned, Yellowknife has now been evacuated as of this weekend, which is astounding to me. And yes, if you could, you know, add them to your prayer list, that would be appreciated. This is also something of a cross-cultural experience for me, because although the Northwest Territories is part of Canada, the North is different, as some of you who have lived there can attest to. Part of the learning curve for me, and it's been a fairly steep one, is that similar to many places across Canada and here as well, we are aware that in our history, there are events that are not very good. Tragic, in fact. We know this, and we're struggling with it. And part of my job is to come alongside and navigate this history and rebuild some trust and to figure out how we move forward. Now, part of what the territories have done is they have created a two-day course on cultural awareness and diversity, safety, and all those kinds of things. And they asked if I'd be, you know, open to taking it. And I thought, absolutely, this would be great. But I'll be honest with you, I was not looking forward to it. I mean, this is a heavy topic. It's tough stuff. It wasn't, you know, a thrilling endeavor for my part, but I thought this would be a good thing to do. And matter of fact, they even emphasize that when they send out the pre-material and the pre-reading, they make it very clear that they are going to be dealing with some tough stuff, hard themes, tough conversations, but so they wanted you to prepare for it and be ready for it and kind of navigate what that was going to look like. And so we did this two-day course. Now, I can tell you right front, they did an awesome job. It really was. It was incredibly well done. Yes, it was challenging. Yes, it was difficult. Yes, there was lots of emotion that kind of went with it. But the focus was very much on we need to understand the past in order to move ahead and do something better in the future. I mean, that was the whole tone of it. And it was just incredibly well done and well received. They had a number of people who shared their stories throughout the 2 days. One in particular was Elaine. Elaine is an Indigenous elder from the area, and she shared her story of what it meant to attend, for her anyways, a residential school. She talked about her substance use issues, and the phrase she used, which caught my attention, was she said, "I left alcohol," which I didn't get a chance to follow up with her, but I found it really interesting that she phrased it that way. I don't know if that was just her way of doing it or whether it actually was on purpose, but it sounded very relational. I left alcohol. She also talked about being a person of Christian faith and how did she reconcile all of the pieces and the history and her faith and the church and all of that complexity. I was discussing this aspect of my work in the Northwest Territories with a colleague of mine, and she asked me, knowing something of my background, "So what do you do with all of that?" And I thought, that is an excellent question. I do not know. But I have been pondering, what do we do with all of that? It's not comfortable. We don't like talking about it. And I'm willing to bet that there are a number of you in the audience today that aren't comfortable. You didn't like the stories that I shared. You had wished I hadn't shared them. Because we don't like talking about that. I agree. It'd be kind of nice to just pretend that none of that ever happened. It's not an issue. And we should just kind of like, let's just move forward and forget about it. That would be easier. But the question my colleague asked me has weighed on me, and for those of you who know me, I tend to ponder. And so when I ponder, I have to work through things. And so I have been pondering this for some time now, and I thought what I would do is take this opportunity to share some of my ponderings, because as uncomfortable as the topic and the theme might be, it has driven me back to God's story, to wrestle with what I see and find there. And I think I've, you know, relearned, rediscovered, appreciate anew some of the teachings there, and I'd like to share them with you this morning. The passage that, I mean, there's a number of them, but the passage that I was particularly drawn to is one of my favorites. It's in the book of Micah, chapter 6. It's one that I've memorized early on, and I'm sure it'll be familiar when we get there to many of you. But before we do, I want to give you a little bit of context, because I think it'd be helpful just to make sure we're kind of tracking the same way. We don't often spend a lot of time with the Old Testament prophets, do we? right? Like, this is not a place where we spend a lot of time for, I think, any number of reasons. In large measure because, well, frankly, the material is just confusing. I mean, it's a mix of odd imagery and different styles. It's not written chronologically. It's kind of all over the place. And even any historical reference is very, very specific often. And so if you're not, you know, really, you have to do a lot of work to kind of figure out what the connections are. And so there's some barriers that take, you know, that we really have to work through. But I think the biggest barrier, frankly, is that we have a different understanding of the word prophet than they did. See, I'm willing to bet that when you hear prophet, you think someone who foretells the future, right? That's what we're thinking about. But that really wasn't at the core of what an Old Testament prophet did. An Old Testament prophet was essentially a spokesperson, right? So what happened was, as things were moving along and God decided that he had something he wanted to share with his people, he would choose someone to speak it for him. And this person was called a prophet. And so the prophet's main job was to share, this is what God is saying. And it dealt very much with a particular circumstance that was happening in their midst, and then often or sometimes with an eye to the future. So once we get a handle on that piece, we understand a little bit more of what's going on. And if we were to, I think, glimpse, so Micah is what we call an 8th century BC prophet. So he is in the 700s. Okay, and so if we were to look in and get a glimpse of what was going on in Micah's day, this is what I think we would see. We would see a time of relatively political stability. Things were relatively calm in that regard. Religiously, worship was centered primarily around the temple that had been established and other outlying places and had been in place for some time, and they were set. Economically, they were prospering. Socially, there was more of a set different thing. They were no longer a nomadic people. They had settled into the land and thing and structure. And from a very human perspective, things were not so bad. But God saw something different. God saw something deeper. God saw something concerning. And so he taps Micah from Moresheth on the shoulder and says, I have a word I would like to share. And away we go. Micah chapter 6 starts this way. The first part of the chapter is set up kind of like a legal context. It's like a court setting. And what's happened is so you have one person, God, who kind of lays out a claim, and then the people respond and back and forth. And that's what it looks like. Here's what God has to say to his people. Arise, plead your case before the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice. Listen, you mountains, to the indictment of the Lord, you enduring foundations of the earth, because the Lord has a case against his people. Even with Israel, he will dispute. In other words, I'm not happy. My people, what have I done to you, and how have I wearied you? Answer me. In other words, what he's saying is, am I just too much for you? Like, are you just tired because of what I've asked you to do? And he said, let me remind you of our story. Indeed, I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I ransomed you from the house of slavery. And I sent before you all these leaders, Moses, Aaron, Miriam. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, was counseled. Or what Balak, king of Moab, counseled. What Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. And from Shittim and to Gilgal, in order that you might know the righteous acts of the Lord. Now again, remember I said about all those little historical references. Essentially, this is what God is saying. Do you not remember your story? Do you not remember where you came from? Do you not remember that you were slaves in Egypt and I delivered you from that? And I provided you all of this guidance and leadership and these little places along the way that along the journey I provided for you. And each one of these references has a story behind it that the people would have known very well. And the reason God is saying this is because they had forgotten all of that, and while they thought things were going well, what God saw was idolatry and injustice. And if you read other portions of Micah, we get a glimpse of what those injustices were. So for instance, Micah talks about people who go to bed at night scheming how to defraud people, and then when they wake up, they do it. He talks about individuals who have power in the gate, which is, and for some of us who went to Israel, we learned this, right? That in the gate, this is where the king or the ruler of a city would sit and judge cases. And so what Micah is saying is there are individuals who have kind of the ear of the ruler. And so when a case comes up, they get the opportunity to skew things in their favor. And then he talks about the merchants who have an interesting set of weights. So in the economy, what they would do is you'd have scales. And if you came and brought wheat, they would put it on a scale and weigh it. But they had two different measurements. So if you were selling your wheat, right, their weight would be a little bit heavier. So it felt like you weren't giving as much, and vice versa. And so God sees all of this and says, don't you remember who you are? Why are you not living this way? And this is how the people respond. They come back and they say, what do you want from us? With what shall I come to you and bow myself before the God on high? Now, some commentators talk about there's a sarcastic tone in their response, which is maybe why I'm kind of drawn to the passage, right? Right. So there's that, what do you want from me? Shall I bring to you burnt offerings with yearling calves? Well, the answer is yes, in part. That is what God asked. And then they expand it. Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams? In 10,000 rivers of oil. Like, they're just like, is this really what you want from me? And then they really cap it off. Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts? And one of the most powerful statements, I think, in the passage, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul. Is this what you want from me? In other words, their response shows that they have no clue what God is talking about. Because they come back, God says, you've forgotten your story. You've forgotten who you were. You've forgotten the response that's supposed to happen. And they just come back and double down and say, hey, we're doing what you asked us to do. Do you just want more of it? What had happened was this. Israel had the structure of their worship down pat. They knew how to go through the motions. They knew what the festival cycles were. They knew what the sacrifices were for. They did all of that, but they forgot the heart and the soul of it. They forgot why they did it. And to put a little bit of a fine point on it, it's so easy to do this, even for us today, is it not? We show up at church because church starts at 10. This is where we're at, right? And we sing our songs and we do our thing and that. Now, I'll have more to say in a minute. I'm not saying those are bad, that's the point. But if we lose the soul and the heart and the reason why we gather together, we miss out on what God is trying to tell us. And this is where I want to spend most of our time as we get into it. It's verse 8. He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Now, just a word quickly, because now with my diversity training, I'm more inclusive, right? When he says, oh man, that's all of us, right? And actually, there's more of a layer to it there, because actually in the text, it literally, the word there is Adam, for Adam, human. It literally means mortal. And it's like God is, I'm good with this. Hopefully you're good with this. You notice I mentioned the sarcasm that's coming, from the people. It's like God gives it back a little bit. He kind of looks and says, oh, okay. Mortal, let me just remind you of where things are truly at. He says, you know what I want from you. This is what I want. And he lays out three very simple things that are incredibly profound and layered and deep. So let me just share some thoughts with you as we kind of unpack some of this. The first one that he mentions is this, to do justice. Matter of fact, this is hard. This phrase that's used here is used over 400 times in the Old Testament, and usually in reference to God. It's impossible to escape that justice is at the very heart of God's nature. And injustice is one of the things that really, truly angers him. Over and over and over again, the people are reminded that we are, because of what God has done for us, he fully expects us to share that with those around us. That at the very heart of his expectation is we are supposed to treat each other with respect. That it's not negotiable. He's saying it should be part of your DNA. You should know this stuff. And it's not just about how we treat other people, but it actually is proactive. The word actually implies that we're looking for ways to care for the needs, to make sure and protect those who might be exploited or mistreated in our culture. It's an incredibly powerful concept. Often in the Old Testament, the focus of this language were three categories of people: widows, orphans, strangers in the land. It gets repeated over and over again. It gets picked up again in James in the New Testament, if you take a look. In part because those were the most vulnerable people in that culture. They had little to no social standing. They had no power. They had no voice. And so they were called, the people were called to make sure those most vulnerable in their midst were cared for, were not taken advantage of, and the people had lost this, and God wanted to remind them. So what do we do with all of this? Back to the question. Well, there's lots that we could talk about, but just to kind of focus in on one thing, justice is really about power and how we use it. And as you think about your day, and I'm guessing most of us don't do this, is can you identify the power that you have? And my guess is most of us would say, I don't think I have a lot of power. But actually, and I'm going to steal from Steve's message from just before he went on holidays, because I thought he did an excellent job of laying it out. Remember the message where he talked about Jesus washing the disciples' feet, right? And the disciples and the people, you know, they were looking for a king. And Steve talked about how, you know, Jesus didn't pick up a scepter and ruled, he picked up a towel and served. And this is what we're talking about when we talk about a Christian view of power. See, what Jesus does is he flips it on its head. You've heard this phrase over and over again, right? This upside down kingdom that we talk about. Jesus used power differently. Jesus showed that power kneels rather than standing. And I think this gets to the heart of what God is asking us to do. So you might not think you have power, but ponder this. Like, do you have power? And I took notes. Steve, I took notes. There you go. Good job. Right? So we talk about, because I was listening to this saying, yes, this is what I want to share. We're already here. But just to remind you, you might have financial resources that others do not have that give you an advantage or power. You might be an expert in some area or have knowledge in your organization or have organizational power that gives you that standing, that place, that power. You might have personal power because of your charisma, your personality, or some other thing that our society values. You might have social power for those very same reasons. See, I will tell you, and I do this in another format, that each of us has power. There's always a power imbalance in every interaction that we have. And the question isn't whether you have power or not. The question is very much, it's a stewardship issue. Is how do you use it? See, power can be good or bad. It depends on how it's used. Just because you have power, it's not a bad thing. The question is, what do you want to do with it? And God has some insight into how he thinks you should use your power. One leadership author that I read put it this way. I like this quote. The difference between how a person treats the powerless versus the powerful is as good a measure of human character that I know. How do we treat the most vulnerable in our midst? How do we use the power that we have? So here's our takeaway, a little bit of homework. You can ponder this before I move on to the next. Ask yourself this week, how can you use power differently? What opportunities do you have to flip power on its head? Can you take a look at your own life and my own life and ask yourself, where do I have influence, favor, position, and how can I use those things to benefit others rather than just myself? How can I give a voice to those who aren't being heard? How do we best advocate for those who are most vulnerable in our world? Tough stuff, but at the core, I think, of what God is asking us to do. The second phrase, to love kindness, I have to admit, I kind of always just kind of skipped over that one because it sounded kind of wishy-washy. Kindness. Yeah. Really? And then you start spending some more time and you start to realize that this too is a rather layered and involved comment. Matter of fact, again, the word behind kindness, this one is used 250 plus times in the Bible. It is a very complex word and we translate it a number of different ways. I have given you the North American Standard Version because this is the one I grew up with. It's the one I'm comfortable with, and it translates kindness. But if you take a look at your own versions, it talks about mercy, grace, loving kindness, compassion. It's an incredibly diverse, rich word. It has all kinds of pieces to it. And often this word is used to describe God's response to his people. God shows kindness to us. He shows mercy to us. He shows compassion to us. It's the entire biblical story. And he's reminding his people, remember your history. And because I have shown this to you, I want you to show it to others. Now, there is a lot that can be said here, but let me just share one thread of one aspect that I think helps. Kindness, I think, is often expressed in our words. And it actually ties in with the first concept because power is often expressed in our words. In our culture, we tend to take words rather lightly, don't we? We just talk all the time, just flows, right? We don't think about it. But in other cultures, words are very, very powerful. They have meaning. In some cultures, they actually believe that words actually exist. They are concrete things that come into existence. It's a fascinating concept. Now, you know this. We got a little bit of audience interaction. My mother was good with these kinds of phrases, right? So you know this one, right? If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. Yeah, she's quoting Thumper's mom from Bambi, the Disney Bambi. I always wondered where that came from. That's where it came from. You know this one. Here's the other one that she likes. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but guess what? That's a lie. My mother lied to me. I'm crushed. I'm just like, she lied to me because that one is not true. Well, it's only partially not true, but it's not true. It is true. Sticks and stones will break your bones. But guess what? Names hurt. They just do. Now, I understand why, and you've probably shared these. You've lied to your kids as well because you want them to protect them a little bit and a little bit of a, you know, thick skin and all of that. But the reality is it's not true. Let's try this. You don't have to put your hand up. I've done this exercise a number of times in a different context, so you don't have to put your hands up, but just think about it. How many of you can recall a criticism or a critique made of you that was years ago, but you can remember it and still feel it? Yeah. Lots, right? My apologies for bringing it to mind. I do this exercise in a team building thing that I do. And I had a woman tell me, I would have rather have been slapped across the face than to hear the words spoken. Because the words hurt more and lasted longer. Words matter a great deal. They are often how we express power. Kindness and justice are at the heart of what God is asking us to do. And I honestly think, as I've learned into this, that simple kindness could truly revolutionize the world that we live in. I debated whether I'd include this quote. It hits a little hard, but here you go. Brendan Manning, in his book Ruthless Trust, which our radical mentoring group read, included this quote from Thomas Cahill. He says, as we stand now at the entrance to the third millennium since Jesus, we can look back over the horrors of Christian history, never doubting for an instant that if Christians had put kindness ahead of devotion to good order, theological correctness, and our own justifications, if we had followed in the humble footsteps of the heretical Samaritan who is willing to wash somebody else's wounds rather than in the self-regarding steps of the priest and the immaculate steps of the Levite, the world we inhabit would be a very different one. We cannot change the past. But I think we have an amazing opportunity to redirect the future by simple kindness to those around us. So your takeaway question is simply this for this one, a little bit of homework. Simply this, in the weeks ahead or the days ahead, what words do you have the opportunity to speak that empower, uplift, encourage, edify? Not in a fake way, but in an honest, genuine. How do you speak kindness into somebody's life? Last one I want to share with you is kind of the capstone to walk humbly with your God. This phrase actually brings it, all three of them actually flow together. You can't really pull them apart. But this phrase actually brings the first two into a focal point. It clearly establishes at the heart of what it means to be a believer in God and his story. It's simply this. It's the recognition of the enormous disparity between God and us in every category, and makes his will, his character, his glory the center of our very existence. And we don't like this. Tough, isn't it? I don't want to do that. I like it when I'm the center of people's universe. I like it when things go my way. Don't you? It's tough to kneel. It's tough to acknowledge. And I think we struggle with this in our church, largely speaking, is because we have kind of a both end thing, right? We are important. We talk a great deal about Jesus being God, coming close and being our, you know, friend and all of that. And that's important. I don't want to lose sight of that. But sometimes when we overemphasize how close God comes, we forget how enormous he actually is, right? Because he's massive. And God calls us to humbly accept that as important and as valuable as we are, that we truly understand very little of who he is and how he works. He asks us to trust him. I don't know if I can put this any more pointed. This phrase literally says, he's asking you to make him the complete and central orientation for every aspect of our lives. It's a major shift in focus. I think Manning is also helpful here as well. So in that book, Ruthless Trust, he's trying to illustrate the glory of God, right? How big he is. And so Manning points to Upsilon Andromedae, which is discovered a while ago by astronomers. It is the first multi-planet system around a star ever discovered besides our own where we live. And what's unique about this, it's bright enough that we can see it with the naked eye, but it is 264 trillion miles away from us. 264 trillion miles. That's longer than a drive from Calgary to Yellowgrass, Saskatchewan in July without air conditioning. That's longer than a flight from Toronto to Tel Aviv in a windowless window seat after you bought a preferred seat with extra legroom that the airline gave away on you. Sorry, that's an inside joke for the Israeli people. I can explain it later. It is 264 trillion miles. So Manning's point is simply this. That's big. It's huge. It's massive. It defies comprehension. Like, we don't even have the words to describe how big that is, what that means. And his point is simply this. This is God's universe. This is his creation. This is who we worship. This is who we humbly bow to. He's massive. He's huge. And we struggle with this in large part, especially when we come to the justice bit, because what do we do with this? And again, we wrestle with it because Jesus came close and all of that. And I think we get too comfortable. See, just like Micah's time period, I wonder if sometimes we get a little bit too comfortable with Jesus. Here's another illustration that maybe helps a little bit with this. C.S. Lewis is a master, right? He wrote his Chronicles of Narnia. And one of the books is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And in that book, he has his character, Aslan, who represents Jesus. And when Aslan enters the story, Susan, one of the main human characters, asks this question, right? Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. Safe, says Mr. Beaver, who's one of the main animal characters in the book. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. And I think this is what Mike is trying to get and God's trying to get, is that humility is just recognizing God is massive, and yes, there's a lot to him and we don't understand, but he is good. I think this is particularly hard when it comes to issues of justice, is it not? I think one of the most challenging, and I run into this all the time, I'm assuming you do as well, that one of the most challenging aspects is it sure seems like God is playing the long game. Doesn't it? He taken forever. Mercy be. He's just so incredibly patient. I'm guessing you voice, if I was God, I'd do it differently. Good thing I'm not, right? He's just so slow. His timing is unfathomable to me. I don't get it. And yet he asks us to trust that he knows what's going on, that he in his story is bringing about things, better things. But along the way, again, for reasons I cannot comprehend, he kind of lays it on us and says, but in the meantime, while I'm doing what I'm doing, I fully expect you to do what you're supposed to do. So this humble piece, you know, with God, I think actually overflows and translates into our human relationships as well. Let me try to illustrate this for you. I am well aware that by being born and raised in Edmonton, that I have a head start, an advantage, as it were, a greater appreciation of what it means to cheer for a good hockey team. Others around may not have had the same opportunities. I appreciate this. Okay, so you may not appreciate that illustration so much, but I had to get it in there. Here's another one, and I owe this one to Jeff Barrett, a friend of mine. Jeff shared this with me a number of years ago. I wrote it down. So Jeff is a personal trainer, and one of his clients that he was working with runs mountains for his fitness. Runs them, right? Some of us crawl, he runs. And on this particular day, he ran four separate mountain faces with an accumulated elevation gain of 5,000 meters. Now, for those of us who climb, ponder that. For those of you who don't climb, that is a lot. Like, that is a lot. And he was on his fourth ascent, and he was really struggling, really working. And he had his poles out, those trekking poles, and he was just really trying to, and it was hard. And another climber walked by him and looked at him and said, oh, come on, man, it's not that hard. Yeah. Yeah, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? Working in healthcare has been an amazing experience for the last 10 years. And what I've learned amongst many things is this. We don't all start in the same place in this life. We really don't. I could share all kinds of stories with you, but I'm really not supposed to, right? Like, I have to be careful about that confidentiality piece. I had one person put it this way. Look, if I haven't had a drink before noon, I'm doing good. Okay, that's good to know. See, we don't all start in the same place. Your story is not the same as my story. You know, the benefits, things that maybe you had, maybe I didn't, and vice versa. And I think the approach we need to take is to realize that if we can grab that concept, that it is always a good idea to lead with grace. That when we're encountering people who we truly do not understand and we don't appreciate, we may not even like them. They may not even like us. But what if it was, I humbly walk before my God also means I humbly bow before and try to understand somebody else's story in a way that is beyond my comprehension, but I appreciate that we don't all start at the same place. I think it would change our conversations and our approach with people. So here's the takeaway for that one for this week. There's actually a couple. I wrestled with this one. Part of it is just, could you take a step back and realize that those who are amongst you, perhaps it's a family member, perhaps it's a coworker, a friend, perhaps it's your neighbor, perhaps it's your nemesis, but just to take a step back and ask, where's their starting point? And how do I understand their story rather than just thinking about my own story? And if you really want to take this to the next level, and I suggest the reason I wave it on this is, don't do this just as a thing to do, but with genuineness behind it. But can you identify that person in your life who you truly struggle with? You just don't get it. And if you have the honest opportunity to sit down and ask, Would you share your story with me? In my line of work, what I do is I have found a phrase that is gold to me. Simply walk into a scenario, because I often get called into scenarios when they're not going well, and I simply use this phrase. Can you help me understand how you see things? And it opens so many doors when asked genuinely. So if you really want to take this to the next level, let's take a look. Can you find someone to sit down with and say, help me to understand? And if you're genuine, it opens dialogue, conversation. So what do we do with all of this? Well, justice is hard. It gets expressed in kindness, mercy, compassion. But I think we may not be able to change the past, but I sure think we can chart a better way in the future by simply looking for grace in our moments. Which brings me to this. We always close our service. See, here's our ritual. You know what comes next, don't you? You're waiting for it. You see, you're waiting for me to pick up this cup because now you know that we are done. I'm done speaking. You only have to listen to one more song. You get to go home. Right? Right? Because we fall into that. This is so easy. But can I share a little bit? See, in so many ways, communion, each time we take it, is a reminder of our story. And just like DNA was supposed to be the people in the, justice was supposed to be in the DNA of the people of Israel, I believe it's also supposed to be in our DNA. And the cross reminds us of this. See, think of it this way. The cross is the true leveler in all of our lives. Paul in Galatians puts it this way. There's neither slave nor free, Jew or Gentile, male or female. There are no more social classes. Jesus died for all. It's not race, it's not heritage, it's not social or economic status that ultimately bring all of us together in this auditorium. It is our love for Jesus and our love of Jesus that binds us together. The rest is story. So as our worship team comes up and leads us in our last song, if you can, and this is me every Sunday, is to think through, yes, it's a ritual, but it is so much more. So during this time, if you could just ponder, how does the cross change my view when it comes to sharing, right, my life with other people's and appreciate what God has done?